Chapter 3. When Johann awoke, his chambers in the palace were eerily quiet. Suites were kept open in the West Wing for any of the electors whose business might bring them to the city. He occupied his with only a few servants, while down the passageway was quartered the huge retinue required by the Countess Emmanuel von Liebewitz and her brother. Usually he was awakened by the flurry of activities required by the Countess Elector's levee. Today he slept well past that. He dressed himself, but called in Martin, his valet secretary, to trim his beard. Afterwards, as he ate a breakfast of fruit and cheese, he went through the day's communiques. There was a long letter from Eidsvik, his steward back in Sudenland, reporting on the harvests and requesting his approval for certain charitable gestures. The von Mecklenburg estates had done well enough this year not to need to draw on the tithe of farm goods it was entitled to collect from the outlying farms, and Eidsvik suggested contributing the offerings to the poor. Johann decided to go along with it, and dictated a brief assent to be sent off, along with a document granting the steward power of attorney for a further 2 months, while he concluded his business in Altdorf. Then there was a note in precise script from Professor Schaet at the university, setting out simply Wolf's attendance record for the past few terms, and hinting in more complex terms that Johann's brother could only remain enrolled on his course if he were to attend more lectures or pay larger bribes. Johann had no immediate answer. He could not bring himself to think of Wolf in connection with the murders in the docks, but he could also not forget the wolf-faced giant he had faced at the top of the world. Could innocent blood really wash away such a monster forever? Before Harald Kleindienst found the beast, Johann would have to find Wolf. There was a notice of the cancellation of the victory parade and a circular of the Emperor's orders for the day. The Imperial militia were to take up their fog positions to perform fog duties. Johann, still relatively new to the capital city, didn't know what that meant, but Martin explained that it was a traditional measure. Even the palace guard would find employment in the fog. Under the circumstances, Johann thought that putting more armed men on the streets was a compromised blessing. Finally, there was an invitation to a private party at the Matthias II, to be hosted by the Bretonian ambassador, de la Rougière. Johann was about to crumple that card and throw it away, when he remembered that Marguerite Ruttmann had died next to the Matthias III. What was de la Rougière's connection with the place? And who else was included in the invitation? Martin did not know. He decided to put off a decision. It might perhaps be a sound idea to attend this party. There were people who said that the beast was a dwarf. Today, Johann wanted to seek an audience with the Emperor to discuss the beast. He had been doing too much in Karl Franz's name without having strictly gained the right to use it. Before this went any further, he wanted official approval. There was a commotion, and Luitpold exploded into the room in a flurry of velvet. "Uncle Johann," he said, "come quickly."
"What is it?"
"Von Liebewitz is fighting a duel in the gymnasium to the death."
Simon Ruhak made Rosanna wait until Hasselstein had finished his breakfast. She stood outside the lector's chambers, fidgeting. If she was wrong, she would look foolish. But she was not wrong. On her way to Hasselstein's office, she had seen Tylo emerging guiltily from the confessional. She wondered how much he had told his cleric about her and his feelings. Impure thoughts were as much sin as impure deeds, but that didn't make people any more comfortable around someone who could genuinely judge them by their thoughts. She still felt the dead girl's wounds. Rosanna was not even the first to have an audience with the lector. Hasselstein's door opened and Adrian Hoven, the cleric captain of the Templars, stepped out. He was wearing his breastplate and helmet, as if prepared to dash off on some military venture for the greater glory of Sigmar. Hoven took no notice of her and barged past. She recognised a packet of sealed orders in his mind.
concealed even from her prying thoughts, and understood that he had been charged with some secret, urgent task.
"Enter," decreed Hazelstein.
She stepped into his chambers and found him dressed exactly as he had been last night. He had either slept in his clothes or not at all. A breakfast tray was abandoned on the floor, and he was drinking tea from a monogrammed mug.
"Lecter," she said without formalities, "the beast has killed again. I saw it in a dream."
Hazelstein choked and spilt tea down his shirt. As he dressed, she prepared for her sleep. In the fog, the heavy curtains weren't necessary, but she drew them all the same. Watching Genevieve, Detlef Sierck was conscious of the difference, apparent and real, between their ages. Another sonnet was forming in his mind. When she was asleep, he would set it down. He had been writing sonnets almost since the beginning, since the play in the fortress, but he had not shared them with her, had not sought to publish them. The plays were for everybody, but the poetry was private. When the time was right, he would have the whole cycle printed and bound up for her. He had a title,
"To My Unchanging Lady."
Pulling on his trousers, he was aware that he would need a new wardrobe soon, unless he lost some weight. He was prepared to do anything to become healthy and slim, except take exercise, eat less, go to bed early, or give up wine. Detlef sat with her as she lay on the bed, waiting for the deep sleep to come, to give her a little of the death she had staved off for so long. They talked, not the high-flown talk of new lovers, but the intimate, ordinary talk of an old married couple. However, lately, people who did not know Genevieve was a vampire had begun to mistake her for his daughter. There were always actresses to tempt him, and Genevieve did not tap him overmuch for fear of bleeding him dry, so they both had to pursue outside interests. But they were very special to each other. Without Genevieve, he might never have built his genius into a real career. He could easily have spent his life boasting of the theatre he would one day create without actually doing anything. "The farce is played out," he was saying. "Our audiences don't want to laugh any more. It's the beast. He has brought horror to the city, and the people can't shake it off, even for the length of a play." Genevieve nodded, comfortable in her near doze, and murmured agreement. She was at her most childlike when she slept. "I shall close A Farce of the Fog at the end of the month, and present something else."
"Horror,"
Genevieve said, almost under her breath.
"Yes, that's a good idea. If they can't laugh, perhaps they can still scream. We have done Drachenfels to death, but there is still the story of the Wittgenstein family and its monster, or of the horrid fate of the von Diehl brothers. Either of those would make a play that would curdle the spine and shiver the blood."
Genevieve mumbled.
"You know what I mean, Genet?"
Detlef thought some more.
"Of course, those are stories of monsters and demons. Perhaps the beast requires something a little closer to home, a little more intimate in its horror."
Genevieve's eyes were closed, but she could still hear him.
"The beast suggests the story of a man who is outwardly a mild, devout, conscientious individual, but inwardly a fiend, thirsting for blood. No offence, Genet. Some citizens say our murderer is a beastman or a demon, but my informants in the watch tell me they are definitely looking for a human culprit. There's that old Kislevite play by V.I. Tyodorov, The Strange Case of Dr. Zaikiel and Mr. Chaida. It is the story of a humble, respectable cleric of Shalia who samples the forbidden potion and becomes a raging, animalistic libertine. It's gross, of course, but I can prepare a loose translation with some improvements, some major improvements." The vampire was asleep, but Detlef was seized by his idea. Of course, the transformation scenes will require all my stagecraft. I want a scene to make people forget the beast, to make them confront their real horrors, the horrors that come from inside. It will be a masterpiece of the macabre. The critics will quake and foul their breeches. Women will faint all over the house, and strong men will be reduced to abject terror. It will be wonderful. Genet, my darling, this will frighten even you.